this computer. Okay, so you should have heard the little announcement. This meeting is being recorded. And what I'll do is I'll record these sessions. And then at the end of the day, I'll take the sessions and I'm going to try to edit them, trim them up a little bit. Like this morning, I anticipate taking a 10-minute break in the middle of this two-hour lecture. And I'll try to edit out that 10-minute break. I'll just turn the camera. I'll turn my camera on mute for a minute. I'll put some music on. We'll take a 10-minute break and then we'll come back and then we'll do some more work. It's just 2 hours is a long time to be in front of a screen and to be doing that. So we will take breaks periodically. And then I'll try to edit out those breaks when I post the video. I don't anticipate trying to break the video up into super small chunks. By the time you go through and you take a two-hour video and you try to split it up by content into little tiny chunks, that's a whole lot of movies and a whole lot of editing. And I think in the format that we're going in a 6 weeks class, where I'm in class from 8 a.m. until 3 o'clock, a little after 3, and I'm in there straight for that entire time. And then I've got office hours from 3:30 until like 5:15. So there's not going to be a whole lot of time for me in the day to create the content that I want to create and also heavily edit the videos. But I'll do the best I can just to chunk out the dead space in them so that what you've got is good content. Okay, so I've introduced myself. I've talked a little bit about recordings. We've learned a little bit about the Zoom environment and how to interact with me and how to ask questions and do that. The next thing I want to do is show you where some of your resources are located. Thanks. Okay. And hopefully I didn't ask either. This morning, everything was working really well. The lab this morning, the Zoom seemed to be very stable. I think my microphone is working acceptably. So I think that you guys can hear me okay. At least that was the way. And I've got earphones on, so I'm hearing exactly what you guys are hearing. And it sounds like it's coming through okay. And the camera feed looks like it's pretty good. So you guys can see pretty well what I'm doing. And my internet is very stable down here and I've got a great internet connection. In fact, behind me, I almost hesitate to show you this. It's kind of scary. It's my entire networking cabinet that my house is wired for gigabit Ethernet in every room. Everything is like super hardwired. So the internet is like, I was designed for going into COVID and going online. All of that I did by myself. In fact, actually, that's miles of wire in my ceiling. But my computer, once in a while, decides to crap out. Once in a while, it decides that it's done and it needs a vacation and it just shuts down. If that happens and you lose me, hang on, and it'll take me about 2 minutes in total, I think, to get back, maybe about a minute and a half. The computer restarts pretty quickly, and then I can jump right back into the Zoom session and we can keep going. It hasn't happened to me yet in the entire time that I'm on Zoom, but like last night, I was working and my computer just decided to shut down last night. So just if that happens, please stay on the line. Class is not over. I will jump back in. We'll finish things up and we'll keep going. Okay. So that's all of that. Let's start a bit of screen sharing and I will take you through the syllabus and show you where the course website is located. So there's a couple of different pieces that we're going to cobble together. We're going to have our Zoom meetings. We're going to have an online website where I maintain course materials on that online website. That is my website that is away from Cabrillo at this point. And then we're also going to have Canvas. And there will be redundant information on the website and on Canvas. All of your assignments will be turned in through Canvas. However, I have to publish those Canvas shells. And those Canvas shells right now are empty. So I need to populate a few things into them, get them started, and then turn them on, and then I'll start getting the redundant information in there. Right now, my website is a little bit more fleshed out, although there's still some things that I'm trying to fix and get going there. So let me take you to that and show you where that is located and how that's going to work. So I need to screen share here. And then once that screen shares, we'll get that to come up. Which it did not. Okay. Zoom has changed some things. Every once in a while when they update the app, so many people are using it that they're updating it more regularly. Each time they update it, little things change and I have to get used to those little things every once in a while. Okay, so you should be able to see my screen now. And this is the screen that is on my iPad. And I tend to screen share from the iPad and use my camera and my computer to be able to still see my face and see me talking to you guys. So you can sometimes see a little window within that screen share. And what records on the video is mainly the screen share and that small little window of me talking to you all the time. So I try to also pay attention and look at the camera as I'm speaking. Although when I'm writing, you'll see me looking down a lot as I'm looking down at the iPad. So what I want to do is I want to take you guys to this website. This is chemed.study. And I don't know if you can see that. It's https://chemed.study. And this is a website that I have maintained for years at Cabrillo. However, Cabrillo is now stripping all of the instructors of their websites because they're worried about compliance of the material on those websites. It is California state law mandated that all material that is put online must be compliant for accessibility reasons. And people that are visually impaired or hearing impaired or whatever impairments they have, that all of the material can be accessed by a screen reader. And because they don't feel like they can trust the instructors to manage that, they're taking away all the instructor websites and all of the instructor resources and forcing those instructors to put all of that material into Canvas, where you are forced to be compliant within Canvas. So I have moved this site off of the Cabrillo website and started my own, which is now chemed.study. And chemed.study, if you just type it into the browser, chemed.study comes up, and it just comes up with my main webpage that's there and my contact information, my office hours, my teaching schedule, all of those things, and links that take us back to Cabrillo links are all at the bottom of the screen. And on the right-hand side of the screen, I have all my course pages for the courses that I teach. That's the Chem 12A, the Chem 12B, the Chem 30A, which is an equivalent class to this, but for allied health. And then I've split the Chem 3 into Chem 3 and Chem 3L so that there are separate web pages for both the lab and the lecture component. And since we're talking about the lecture component today, I'm going to click the link for the Chem 3 site and take you there. It's a pretty sparse page. There's not a whole lot that's here right now. But it has the syllabus. It has an incomplete schedule that I'm working on and figuring out how to adjust to this new textbook as well. And then it has a link for the lab Zoom recordings, or it'll say lecture Zoom recordings, but those will be the Zoom recordings. We'll all be under that page. So let's go to the syllabus and show you that. The syllabus is pretty much done. I'm liking pretty much where it stands. It has our course name and the description of the course there. It has my instructor contact information and the hours for office hours that are there. A note about the Zoom meetings and the office hours. I put those out in the email as well. So there is a link to the office hours in the email. I am not planning on putting Zoom links out onto the web. I'd rather have the Zoom links only invitation. And so I will put them within Canvas when I get the Canvas shell up and running. But like I said, I'm just going to email them out periodically so that you guys have them, so that we don't get any sort of people jumping in who have found the website or found that Zoom link and decided to be annoying and jumping into our Zoom sessions. So I'm not going to publish those in that way. My phone number that's on there is my office phone number at Cabrillo. I'm also not checking that. If you need to get in touch with me and it needs to be more immediate, the best way to get in touch with me is really by email. I read email constantly, and particularly when I'm in an online class, I'm trying to reply to you guys fairly quickly. So I usually just give a disclaimer that I will reply to you within 24 hours. If it's on the weekend, it might be the following Monday when I start to reply, but more than likely, I will reply within an hour or even minutes, just depending upon what I'm doing and what's going on. because I'm checking email constantly. So if it is an emergency and you need to contact me, go ahead and throw it in the email. And like I said, I read it frequently enough that I will get it, even if it's on the weekend. And if it's an emergency, I probably will respond very quickly. If it's not an emergency, or doesn't seem to be, you may be waiting 24 hours for me to get back in touch with you at my discretion. Okay. But rest assured, I will see it pretty quickly. That email is jason.camera@cabrillo.edu. If you look at the Cabrillo website, it lists my email as jacamera@cabrillo.edu. They are one in the same. They are not different emails. So they go to the exact same thing. One is an alias of the other. So it doesn't matter which one you email. I will see both. Okay. Our lecture schedule. Everybody's here. It's 10:20 to 12:25. And the materials that I'm requesting of you guys to have, I thought since we're doing this as an online class, that this was the perfect opportunity to try an open source textbook. So that's what we're giving a shot. This is a textbook that is by OpenStax. I reviewed a number of different open source textbooks, and this is the one that sort of caught my eye as being the most developed. Generally, what I've been afraid of or concerned of with open source textbooks is the quality of the writing and the quality of the instruction within them. And this book has five main authors and something like 15 additional authors that support the textbook. And the textbook is also peer reviewed, meaning that they have sent this textbook out and asked other instructors to utilize it and to comment on it. And I find that the textbook is not only well written, but well supported with images, and that the problem sets in it are reasonable problem sets, that they have actually put significant effort into making consistent problem sets. And so there's significant good practice. There are also in-chapter problems. And the book is designed in sort of a Canvas format so that if you're familiar with Canvas, when you go to read the textbook, it's going to feel like Canvas, like you're already in a Canvas shell. And so all of that was fairly enticing. So I thought we would give it a try and see how it goes. Of course, the added benefit is that it's free. Most of the textbooks for a class like this would run in the $200 range. So having an open source textbook and a free textbook like this, I think is fairly advantageous. And I'm excited to give this a shot and see how it goes. Now, a note about this textbook as well. Somebody let me know that they bought the hard copy of it and that it came in two volumes when they bought the hard copy. And it's because of the size of the textbook. It's a monster textbook. This textbook, I think, is actually designed to support the Chem 1A and Chem 1B content, although I would say that it is on the very basic side for Chem 1A and Chem 1B, which made me feel more comfortable in using it for Chem 3. Still, there's more content in this book than we will cover, so we are not going to cover the entire thing. I'm going to cherry pick, even as we go through the chapters, I may cherry pick within the chapters certain content, and I will try to be as clear as I can where I'm cherry picking and what content that I want you to pay attention to and what content you can avoid. So be aware of that, I'm going to try to work ahead of you too. So as you're reading ahead, and I know many people do, and that's great, and that's what I want you to do, as you read ahead, you may encounter material that is slightly more advanced than I want you to be encountering. So pay attention to the schedule, and if you have any concerns about the content, don't feel free to contact me and make sure that we're doing the same thing, that we're on the same page. Okay. The only other thing that I'm requesting of you, which is an expense, is a scientific calculator. And this is a soft request. What math level is Math 152? Math 152, I think, is the algebra trig component. I need to look it up. Intermediate algebra. Thank you, Eric. Okay, so I think that's probably true. Mainly what you need to be able to do to survive in this class is you need to understand how to handle exponents and logarithms. Logarithms is the heaviest sort of math that we get into. And And we don't get into logarithms until we get into acid-base chemistry, which is towards the end of the six-week semester. So most of the math that we'll be doing is just basic algebra. And so if your algebra is pretty solid and you can handle exponents, you should be golden. Scientific notation and exponents is the main bread and butter of what we wind up doing in here. And it's, like I said, not until acid base and not until we get into radiation and nuclear chemistry do we start doing things with more logarithms. Okay. So the scientific calculator is something that I'm asking you guys to have. And you can use a scientific calculator that's online. There are many websites that will simulate a TI graphing calculator, and that's fine. However, my concern was that that you're going to be working online to some degree. And as you work online, that if you have one single computer monitor that's switching back and forth to the graphing calculator and trying to type and key things in, gets more complicated on a computer than it does on an actual calculator. Using a calculator for problems allows you to get the answer faster and more accurately. For every keystroke that you do, there's something like a 0.5% chance of hitting the wrong key. And for some of the problems, we're going to be hitting the keys, we're going to be hitting 20, 30 keys in order to enter in a single problem. Those errors multiply. And when they're on a keyboard and you're looking up and down rather than a calculator, sometimes it's easy to make calculator mistakes. And I'd rather not have you lose points for calculator mistakes. So learning to use the calculator and learning to use it quickly will support you in Chem 1A and Chem 1B as you move forward. And in Chem 1A and Chem 1B, they're going to do timed exams, timed quizzes. You're going to be under time pressure in trying to complete those exercises. Knowing how to use your calculator and being familiar with it is one of the best skills that I could probably give you. And so getting a good calculator and moving forward with that is something that I think is important. That being said, the TI graphing calculators are very expensive. However, they have TI scientific calculators, which are non-graphing, that are reasonable. They're in the $25 to $30 range. And what I have is some links. I don't know, let's see if I had a link that was put in here. I do. And that link takes you right to TI's website and the different various 30 series calculators that they have. So the 30 series all have a 30 number within them. So there's the TI-30XA, the TI-30X2S, the 30XS, the 34, the 36. All of these calculators would be appropriate for this class. They all handle logarithms, they all handle exponents, they are all solid calculators. So the choice is really up to you in terms of what you feel comfortable with, whether you want something that has batteries or something that has solar, or just whatever sort of calculator it is that you want to use. They will all have similar keys and similar keystrokes for entering, which also makes it easier when we're talking about keystrokes, about how to enter a calculation into the calculator. So like I said, I'm not going to quote a specific calculator that I want you to have. You can use an online one if that helps. You can use your cell phone. Turning your cell phone sideways when you go into calculator mode and then turn it sideways brings up a calculator very similar to a TI. So there's many options there for you. And in regards to the types of assignments that I'm going to give you, all of the assignments that I'm going to give you are going to be open-ended, open note, open book, and in a extended time format. So when I give a quiz, I'm going to say, all right, we're going to have a quiz today. The quiz is posted online. It's posted in Canvas. You have 24 hours to complete it. You can then go in and complete that whenever you want. When you start the quiz, there's no clock that starts. It will just be open-ended. You can start it, stop it, save it, come back to it. And oftentimes, I may even give you multiple tries at it. So I may program it in such that you get two or three attempts to answer the problems correctly. I will do the same thing with tests, although I may not give you all the optional tries. You may get one try at the test. We'll have to see how that goes. But it'll be similarly open-ended, where it'll be in a 24-hour format such that you can complete it at your leisure. That's going to support the people who are taking this class asynchronously. It is also going to support you in whatever endeavors that you guys have, because I know that different people are at work and trying to also sometimes be online while they're at work, or things come up, and this will give you a lot more flexibility. It will also help those people with accommodations, because it takes the time commitment out of it. So most of the people that have accommodations have time and a half or double time for tests and quizzes and things. And I think in this format, while we will certainly honor those accommodations, I think that you will find in the 24-hour format that you won't really need them, because the quizzes are generally designed to be a 10-minute quiz or 15-minute quiz. You're going to have 24 hours to complete it. The exam is going to be designed to be an hour and 30-minute exam, which is the way that we normally do exams for a regular semester class. I will not change that format. I will keep my format the same, and I will keep the length of the exam the same. So you'll have 24 hours to do that same amount of material, which should take a lot of the pressure off and make you feel a little bit more comfortable in terms of the way this is going to work. So I hope that that's working for everybody. Now, if you do have accommodations, and we'll talk about this later on too, I certainly want you to let me know that you have them and what those accommodations are. And maybe you and I can have a conversation in office hours and talk about those accommodations so that I can know your learning style and how I can definitely help you. When does the 24-hour mark begin? Now? No, I don't know. It begins whenever I say it begins. It generally begins from the point, like when we have a lecture and we're supposed to have a quiz for that lecture, I would start the 24-hour mark after the lecture, essentially. And I'll definitely give you a heads up. And it's going to be loose. I'm not going to program it in such that it's tight 24 hours. One of the things that I really hate is that, you know, you're pushing up against that deadline and you're trying to get the thing done and the timer quits and everything quits and craps out on you and you don't get it done. I'm going to be a little more flexible than that, because I know that in this time that things are cropping up all over the place and it's not an easy time right now. So I'm also not entirely beholden to that 24 hours. It's not like it's going to drop off on you and disappear. At some point I'm going to cut it off, but that 24 hours is sort of a window that is my ideal window. And if it's a little bit later than that, or we need to do some flexibility, then I consider myself to be a pretty flexible instructor in working with students. So I hope you guys find that as we go forward. Okay. All right. Let me get back out of calculators and back to here. Okay. The student learner outcomes are in here. We're going to learn how to analyze major chemical reactions, predict outcomes of simple ones. We're going to write reactions with chemical names and formulas and balanced equations. We're going to solve stoichiometric problems and unit conversion problems with appropriate conversion factors and significant figures. That's the bulk of what we do, boiled down into a nutshell. I always have a hard time, with student learner outcomes because they're so vague. And we do so much in the class that I don't even know that those student learner outcomes entirely cover everything, but they do a pretty good job. Okay, assessment. How are you going to be assessed? I split it up pretty evenly. Homework, you're going to have homework for every chapter. I'm going to try to figure out how to get that homework into Canvas and to keep ahead of you a little bit. I think I've got the first one already programmed in. I just need to open up the shell and turn it on for you guys. But each of those homework assignments will be worth 10 points. And I think I'm anticipating that we'll go through 15 of the chapters that are in this book out of 20 some odd that are in here. We're going to skip some of the ones that are more advanced that we don't need to do. And we will, like I said, skip some of the in-chapter components as well. But more or less 15 homework assignments, and they'll be 10 points apiece. So that'll be about a quarter of the percent of your grade. Quizzes, I'm going to have a quiz, roughly about 10 quizzes. Each quiz is 20 points. That's roughly two quizzes a week as we go through and do that. Those come out point-wise, because all the points are equal, that comes out to about 28, almost 30% of the grade is in the quizzes. And like I said, those quizzes are open book, open note, and open-ended, and I'm going to give you multiple attempts at solving those problems in there. Exams. The exams are a little more higher point value, and I probably won't give you the multiple attempts at that. That's a little bit more pressure on the exams. That turns out to be almost 30% in terms of two midterms, each 100 points. And the cumulative final is traditional in terms of the class. So we have one final exam, which is not quite twice a midterm. It's like a midterm and a half. And usually what I do is we've split the class up into thirds, if you think about it this way. So we have the first third and the first midterm, second third, the second midterm, third, third, and the final. And the final is cumulative over the two. So half of the final covers the cumulative material. The other half of the final covers the last third of the material that we've covered. That's the way that it sort of breaks down. Sabra, will there be an answer sheet provided so that we can check our answers for the homework? There will be a combination of things. The book actually has answers to many of the problems in the back of the book. And so I will assign a number of problems for which the answers are in the back of the book. And then, yes, I will make an answer key and I will post an answer key for you so that you will be able to review those answers as well. And I will post those online and put the answer keys online on the chemed.study. So yes, you will get all of that. And I haven't looked, I should, but I have not looked to see how detailed the answer key is for the textbook. I think it's probably just an answer and not a detailed explanation. In which case, I'll probably be working out all the problems and just posting an entire key so that you can go through and see all the problems worked out. That's more or less what I am anticipating doing. Okay. So there it is. All the points are equal points, straight up percentages. And it's about 30% on quizzes, 30% on exams, and then 20% on homework and 20% on the final. That's roughly the way that the class works out. And there's no lab component to this. This is just the straight up lecture course itself. The lab is its own course and its own grade and its own everything. Okay. And in that regard, I should take a second to explain and make sure that everybody is where they need to be. I sent out an email that explained what Chem 3 and Chem 3L and how they came about and why they are different classes. UCSC came to us and said that state law was telling UCSC they could no longer offer Chem 3, and they wanted Cabrillo to be able to support the Chem 3 students because Chem 3 was a low-level class that was in the community college domain, essentially, is what the state said, and that four-year universities were not allowed to offer that course. UCSC, in evaluating their curriculum, has lowered the requirements for their entry-level chemistry classes such that lab is no longer required for the Chem 3 class for articulation with UCSC. So UCSC wanted their students to be able to take the lecture course only and not have to take the lab at Cabrillo. So we accommodated UCSC and we split it into two separate classes. Cabrillo has always felt that it is really important for students to have lab and to have that physical experience in the laboratory to learn how to use your hands so that when you move forward into a Chem 1A, Chem 1B, and even Chem 12 class, that you have a development of skill sets of how to handle yourself in a laboratory. So we think that it's very important to actually have the lab be a critical component of the class. So Cabrillo's curriculum, if you're going on to Chem 1A or Chem 1B at Cabrillo, you need the lab class, you need Chem 3L. So if you take Chem 3 right now and you don't take the lab, you will not be able to take Chem 1A in the fall. If you want to take Chem 1A in the fall, you must also complete the lab. They may be taken separately, such that you can take the lecture right now, and then you can take the lab later, but it will put you back in time. So you will have to finish that lab before you can progress within the chemistry sequence. If you are a UCSC student or a CSUNB student, and you are completing this class for an undergraduate prerequisite for your programs, you very likely don't need the lab. And for UCSC, you definitely, CSUNB, I'm pretty sure you don't either. So it really just depends on what your goals are and where you're going next as to whether or not you need the lab. Now, you guys saw that the lab was fairly impacted and there was fairly significant wait lists on both of the labs. I'm just going to go ahead and enroll everybody in the lab, or at least give them permission to enroll in the lab and over-enroll those. It's an added workload on me, but we don't have any physical limitation in terms of the room size. It just means that I get to do a lot more work and not get paid for it. But on the flip side of that, I can't stand the idea of people getting into the lecture and not being able to finish the lab and having to take lab at a later time and putting you back in time. That doesn't make any sense to me. So the administration and I need to have a conversation about either lowering the cap down on this lecture so it accommodates the lab and supports the lab appropriately, or at least increase the lab size so that the instructors are being compensated appropriately. But that's on me. Okay, so that's your lab. And so hopefully you guys are now know what you need to do and whether or not you need to be in lab or not, okay? And if there's any questions, like I said, throw them in the chat. I'm following, or if you need to, unmute your mic. Now, the syllabus is generally a legal contract between you and I. And as such, there are many instructor policies that go in here. Usually these instructor policies are there for in-classroom, in-person types of things. I don't anticipate any of these being any problems in the Zoom format, but I left them in the syllabus just because it's a boilerplate syllabus that I like to use, and I didn't feel like I wanted to just cut it all out. So there are attendance, cell phones, grade disputes, cheating, plagiarism, disruptions, all of those different types of things. Mainly cell phones are disruptive in a lecture, but we're all muting our mics, so there's not a problem there. I don't generally take attendance. I have a show up if you want to learn policy. So if you want to be here, if you want to learn, I understand that you are going to do your best to be here. And that's the mode in which I operate. I need to track you a little bit so that I can make sure that people are actually in the class. And I need to do a census, which is how Cabrillo gets paid. I'm going to do that through Canvas. So I'm not going to try to take roll here. So don't worry about that. We're going to have, I'm going to put like a little dummy quiz into Canvas for you guys to click into, which will tell me that you're active and that you're participating and that you're here. And that'll let me do that component. Grade disputes. This is an impossible format to usually students at the beginning of a lecture or at the end of the lecture will try to have a private conversation with me regarding a grade dispute where maybe I graded something incorrectly or did something wrong. I make mistakes on grades all the time. I'm always willing to look at whatever material it is that you put in front of me and reassess it and think about what was done right, what was done wrong. But the best place to do that is office hours, particularly in this format where it's open-ended and everybody can hear every conversation. So if we need to, we can do a private breakout room within office hours so that we can have a private conversation away from other students and then come back into a group setting and things. So there's ways that we can handle that, but office hours or an email would be the best way to go through and do that. Disruptions, cheating, plagiarism, this is all open-ended, open note, open book, and so I don't anticipate anything with that. Cabrillo has a very strong and beautifully worded non-discrimination and accessibility notice, which I think captures just about every possible possible person in society. It's a great statement that covers gender and age and nationality and military status and pregnancy and mental disabilities, gender identity, gender expression, everything. Everything is covered under that. We do not discriminate against any students in any forms. So I encourage you to read that statement. It's a beautiful statement. And then regarding anybody with disabilities, like I said, please communicate to me if you happen to have accommodations. Communicate to me by email, communicate to me by office hours and having a conversation. And let's talk about what your particular learning style is and how I can best help you. I've had a lot of experience with working with students with learning differences. My own children both have dyslexia and have gone through systems and I'm well versed in all of the different learning disabilities. So I encourage you to speak with me if you fall into that category. And then tutoring. This is a big thing that I want to hit here. There are three different places to get help on campus. So The first place that I would recommend is the STEM and MESA Center. While their physical space is not open, their virtual space is open. They are online and they are here to help. So the STEM Center is not only a physical study space where you can connect with students and chat with students while studying in a Zoom sort of format. That's a great thing in and of itself to be able to work together. But they also offer peer tutoring, and particularly in chemistry. And they will have a chemist tutor who will be online and be able to help you with any of the problems and things that are going on. You need to request that help. So you need to be online and then sort of flag, I guess they'll give you some instructions of how they want you to flag for help if you need help while you're studying online. But those tutors go through some tutor training, and they're generally some of our best chemistry students that wind up tutoring there. Fantastic resource. So I have the webpage for the STEM Center, and also their Zoom link to be able to get into that. And their hours are Monday through Thursday, 11:30 to 6, and Friday 1 to 5. So that link will be active and work for those timeframes. Because of the math component that we have in this class, the Math Learning Center is also a great resource. If you're having problems specifically with math and you need a little bit of math help, they are online and they have tutors available, and their Zoom link is there. They are Monday through Friday, 12 to 5. So they're another good resource. And then perhaps one of the best resources is the Hub Tutoring Center. The Hub hires peer tutors that they retain for a good number of semesters. And those tutors go through significant training, and they work with small groups. So the tutors there work on a schedule. You contact them, say, I'm interested in tutoring. This is my name, my class, all my information. This is when I'm available. They then collate you into groups of similar students who have similar timeframes that they're available. And then in the traditional sense, you would sit and you would go to the Hub and meet in person. But here you'll be meeting in line online, and they'll give you a Zoom link, and you'll probably be fit into a class with 5, 6 or 7 students and go through tutoring sessions. Those tutors are very good. That's Christopher Guthrie. Christopher has been tutoring down there for quite a while. He's got an excellent grasp on the material, and he's got very complimentary ways, creative ways to explain it. So if you're interested in doing that, and that's a limited resource. So unlike the MLC or the STEM, where they take everybody, the Hub does not take everybody. Once they fill up, that resource is then gone, and they don't really have the ability to expand that resource. So if that's something you're interested in, is that peer tutoring, then I would encourage you to send that email to mihaverl@cabrillo.edu. So that link is there and is online. And they want you to send in an email that has your name, your student ID, your email, your phone number, the specific class for our class, Chem 3, your instructor's name, so they know that they're compiling you in groups that are compatible, and the days and time blocks that you are available. They will then contact you and set up the tutoring sessions. So that's a great resource, and many students take advantage of it. However, many students want to take advantage of it once they get into the harder material and realize they need it. I would encourage you that if that's something that you are even vaguely interested in, to go ahead and make the appointment now and get signed up for it. Because once it becomes critical and you need it, sometimes there's not open space for it because everybody else has already jumped into it. So that's a great resource that's there. Okay, and then there's one more resource that's not there, and that's me. I'm the best resource. I don't know, all these resources are great, but I'm the best one. And I get it, I understand. Instructors can be scary. And I've had students who come into my office and they sit in the chair and they push the chair as far back against the wall as they can get, and they'll pull their legs up into the chair and sit cross-legged. And you think that I was a tiger in a cage with them, and the truth couldn't be farther from that. I'm here to support your goals, and interacting with me can only improve your grade. It is never going to detract from your grade. So if you're embarrassed about your instructor seeing what you're having difficulties with, and thinking that that is going to negatively impact you, I would like to encourage you otherwise, that the more interaction I have with you, I'm your biggest cheerleader. I want you guys to be successful. I want you to meet your goals and to be able to move on from here and do whatever it is that you want to do. And I have nothing but the best wishes for you in succeeding in this class, and want to provide you with all the resources and material that I can to make that happen. So interacting with me in office hours and asking me questions and having me help you to learn the material, I've got more experience than any of these tutors, and I've got more ways of explaining things, and I very rarely run out of patience. I'll explain it as many times as you ask it and as many different ways as I possibly can. So I encourage you to take advantage of the office hours too, and take advantage of my time and getting the help that you need. So I want to extend that invitation and make it as heartfelt as I can that I'm here to help you and here to support you. So so definitely keep that in mind. Okay. All right. How are we doing? How's everybody? Everybody still with me? I've been talking for a while. I think we're coming up on an hour, and we got to get to some content here before we go too much further. Okay. Did any questions?
Jason, could I ask a quick question?
Please, Megan. Yes.
I'm having a hard time finding like what chapters are coming up. I've been looking so I can get started on the reading. Are those posted anywhere?
No.
Okay.
That's why you're having trouble finding it. Yeah, we're going to go sequentially. So I'm going to start off in chapter one, and chapter one and chapter two, chapter three, I think as I've previewed them and looked at them pretty closely, I think we're going to do almost all the content that are in there. I have notes that are sitting here in front of me, and I have a first homework assignment sort of already put together. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to try to find a way. See, the difficulty with this online thing, let me, I guess, try to explain this a little bit more in my teaching mode and the way that I teach, is that I don't think of myself as old school, but I teach old school. I tend to teach with me and a whiteboard and a pen and what I can draw and what I can communicate. I make up a tremendous number of problems off the top of my head very fluidly. And I make those questions up based on the questions that I get from you guys to target exactly what it is you need in terms of your learning styles. And I tend to do sort of old school homework and just have people turn it in class, as opposed to using Canvas. I have always avoided Canvas. I have an aversion to Canvas. I have an aversion to every sort of online homework, anything. It makes me insane. Not being able to control my content makes me crazy. And Cabrillo has had a tradition of switching from different online learning formats. Canvas is just the latest one, and I don't know what the next one will be. Although Canvas is very widely adopted through all of the community college system and four-year universities and even high schools. So Canvas might be here to stay, which is unfortunate because I hate Canvas. But many other instructors have the advantage on me in that they have used Canvas for years and they have these shells already built, and they were able to move into this online mode very, very easily, just migrating their Canvas materials over. And I had no such base on which to build from. Fortunately, I do all my web programming from scratch by hand, which is another thing that makes Canvas crazy to me, because I try to make a page look exactly the way I want, and Canvas has the sanitizer script. It goes out and it strips out all the formatting that you put in and makes everything look just ugly, and it makes me insane. So so while I'm extremely computer savvy, I just hate what Canvas is and what it does. But I also can't accommodate 90 students and have you guys turn in paper stuff online. There's just no way I could access it and read it and do all that. So I'm finding myself in a catch-22, having to do something that I really don't want to do, which is try to construct a class more in a Canvas shell. And so, yes, I'm behind where I need to be and where I want to be, but I'm going to be catching up quick. And I'm going to try to communicate those assignments to you as best I can. Right now, read chapter one. And I will post by the end of today the homework that I want for chapter one. And each day I'll get a little bit farther ahead and try to stay ahead of you guys. Does that help, Megan? Okay, cool. You got it. So yeah, I'm leaving you feeling a little empty for resources, and people keep thinking that Canvas is broken. And no, it's your instructor that's broken. It's not Canvas. It's me. I'm just stuck in my old ways, and I have a way of teaching that works for me because it works for my students. And when it's working for my students, I tend not to change until it doesn't work for my students anymore. And I find that I get such positive feedback on the way that I teach that trying to move into these new modes, trying to move into Canvas and do something. I have never in 20 years written a multiple choice question. I have never in 20 years written a true false question. I tend to write questions looking for what you know, not what you don't know. I tend to write questions where I like to read your answers that are more of an essay type answer that allows me to probe and show me what it is that you know within a problem. And I grade with a tremendous amount of partial credit. When that's taken away from me, all I know from a multiple choice or a true false is that you got the question wrong. And I find that they are typically worded in a way to try to lead you to choose the wrong answer. And I don't think that that's a valid form of teaching. I just completely disagree with that. And so I struggle in this format of how do I handle this many students, and how do I do it appropriately with the tools that I have. But we will find our way forward, and we'll make it work. So that's the way it goes. Okay. I've been talking for a while now, and I think I've covered the syllabus. I've covered where the website is, and eventually the schedule link will work. Right now it's got the wrong schedule. It has the labs that are topics and things that are in there from some of the time, and the Zoom recordings. I've got an empty slot where today's Zoom recording is going to go, and it'll fit right in there, and I'll get it posted this afternoon at 5:30 once I cut it up a little bit and chunk out some of the dead air that's in it. And my reason for wanting to put my Zoom lectures here instead of on Zoom or on YouTube is that I just can't stand the commercialization either. So YouTube throws all the commercials onto your videos, and every time a video ends, they pop up with all these other videos that they want you to watch. And I don't want to deal with that. And I don't want you guys to have to deal with that. So these are all going to go on my website, and you'll be able to access them anytime you want. You can have fairly good confidence this website's not going to go down. And I've got infinite space to be able to post the gigabytes of videos that we're going to create. So we're all solid. And let's start lecture. I think that's enough. Unless there's any questions about this website. And then once I get the Canvas shell up and running, that'll be more self-explanatory. And I will send out emails when that happens to let you know that the Canvas is turned on and that I want you guys to go in and experience that and do the first quiz and do the first things. Okay. So I'll give you a second to think if there's any more questions that I can answer. And if not, I'm going to jump in and go to Notability, and I'm going to switch glasses so that I can actually see what I'm writing. And we'll start off checking to see if I've missed anything. I don't think I have. Okay, so I think the one thing that I did not mention is that I think that in terms of expectations for you turning things in, it's going to be a combination. Ellis, I see the question. I'll get that in a second. And can we take a 5-minute break? Yeah, this is a perfect time for a 5-minute break. Let me finish this one little thought and then I'll tell you that. When I haven't turned things in, it's going to be a combination of everything's going to get turned in through Canvas. Nothing's going to be emailed to me. So it'll all be turned in through Canvas. But it'll be a combination of assignments that I create within Canvas that you do like quizzes, and maybe some things that I want to see your work. And so I'm going to ask you to turn in some PDFs on Canvas and upload some PDFs into Canvas. I'm going to put together a little tutorial of how to create those PDFs, how to use your cell phone and some free apps to be able to do that, and most critically, how to name it appropriately. And but that'll all be through Canvas, and so that'll be explained a little bit later. And can we type our responses to questions on quizzes and tests? Yeah, you know, there's I'm going to see, Ellis, in terms of I don't actually know. I'm going to see. It just depends on if it's. No, I don't have a good answer right now. Lost for words. It's going to be a combination of things. And fair enough. And Vincent, here's the website he mentioned earlier. Oh, yeah, that was good to throw that into the chat. ChemEd.study, Chem3. If you just go to the ChemEd.study, that takes you to the splash page and you can access all the rest of it from there. And Vincent, thank you for throwing that in for everybody. That was a good idea so that it's typed in there. I often forget that I can do that. And I tend to just go and write it on the screen. And let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break. This is a good time for that. And we'll reconvene at 11:40. And then we'll go and we'll do some more work from there. Okay? I'm going to put some music on and we'll take a short break. Why is my music not coming up? Maybe what I need to do is I need to stop screen sharing here. And then. Then let's try this. Huh. Does not want to let me put music on. Oh, maybe that's what he ends it where it begins, but I won't let go. Ooh, I know you don't love.
I know you don't love me, but still I'm My heart, and I hope to die if I should ever make you cry, 'cause you're my all, darling, you're a part of me. I swear by every star above, I'll be with you. Please take my love. You're everything a love can be. I'd trade the world for the treasures of your charm. My dear, I'll never be free. Be with me right here in my arms. You're my queen. You'll always be. I swear by all that's real, no love but yours I'll ever feel. I cross my heart, and if I lie, I hope to die.
All right, we're at 11:40. I think it's time to come back online. Let's see, what do I need to do? I need to screen share, stop the screen share, and restart this one. Take me just a second to start broadcast. Good, okay. All right, so we're starting in chapter one. And we're going to do all of this chapter. Let me make sure I'm recording. You guys can hear me. Everything looks good. Everything's working right. And you can see my screen at this point. See notability. And so some of this stuff is not stuff that I necessarily test on per se, but is stuff that we need to kind of do. We need to kind of hit so that other things make sense, so that everything is in context. That's kind of the important component. And so the first thing is that chemistry is broadly encompassing. It hits all kinds of things, so much so that it is called the central science. And as the central science, chemistry informs many other areas of study. And so if you are in material sciences or physics or agriculture, engineering, medicine, biology, food sciences, all of those things are all informed by chemistry. And in order to have a field or to go into any of those. Ooh, let's see. Is my mic down just a little bit? It's a bit low for one person. Okay, let me see what I can do. I think that what I can do. How's that? Is that picking up better? Cool. Okay. So the only thing that I'm going to do then is that if I'm turning my mic up that high, is that I'm going to try to turn. Ah, that's much better. Okay. Yeah, there we go. Okay. I've got both a microphone and the headset, and that if the headset is too loud in the microphone, then I'm just hearing myself in an odd way and it's too much feedback in my brain, but I think I've got it set up now. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. If anything's ever off, if the mic is off or too low or something's not loud enough, let me know and I'll see what I can do to turn things up. Okay. So the other thing about chemistry, not only is it the central science and feeds into everything, and that chemistry touches almost every field, is that the way that we do chemistry is really important. And I think particularly in today's world, where we have so much discrediting of science and discrediting of scientific studies and the way science works, that I find that deeply concerning, because science doesn't have an agenda. People have agendas, but science doesn't really have an agenda. That I guess you would say that science's agenda is really to forward knowledge and to understand. And so the way that we operate within chemistry is that we observe something, and that observation then leads to what we call a hypothesis. It's really a question about how something works. And a hypothesis is a testable question. It's an idea that we have of from our observations how something works. And it's really important that that hypothesis be stated in a way that is testable. And we create an experiment then to test that hypothesis to see whether or not it is true or not. And when we test it, we get two pieces of information. Either we get validation and that hypothesis is true, or we get wrong information that tells us that the hypothesis is not true. And both things are accurate, both things are valid, and both things are important. If we do get confirmation, and that's really exciting when that happens, that we think that we understand a system and we have confirmation that our tests are telling us that we understand it, then we move to publication. And we publish that information in what's called a peer-reviewed journal. We don't publish it online. We don't publish it in an online format necessarily. What we do is we go to a journal that deals with that type of content. And that journal has editors on staff, people who work in the field, and they send that document out to three editors. The editors review the document for its content, for its validity, for its depth, for making sure that it's complete and accurate. And they either recommend it for publication or they deny it for publication, saying that it's missing components. Things need to be done in order to make this a better study. Or the study's not valid in some way, they may flag it. If it is approved for publication, it goes to publication and then it's read by thousands of scientists who work in that field. Those scientists then read it and say, that's interesting, I never really thought about that. Or I think that we should try that and see if that works. And they'll tell their grad students to go into the lab and go try it. And from that one person who did that study, it will fan out and hundreds, if not thousands of people will try to reproduce the work. And if the work has problems and it can't be reproduced, then another publication comes out and says, hey, these people, it didn't work. Whatever this is doesn't work. And that leads to new observations, new hypotheses, and the cycle starts over again. However, if those hundreds or thousands of people who test it find that it does work, then it falls into what we call a theory. So a theory is an idea of how something works that is a preliminary idea that has been verified by a large number of people and seems to work. But we don't call it a law until it's been around for 50, 70, 100 years and been tested thousands and thousands of times. And when something has been tested thousands and thousands of times and we always get the same result, regardless of how many times we test it or where it's tested, then we call something a scientific law. And even a scientific law is not an absolute. A scientific law is not immutable. We can change these things and frequently do as our ability to measure and test becomes better. So as our instrumentation and our ability to conduct more rigorous tests becomes better and better, new information comes in, and we reassess even those things that we think of as chemical laws. And so the science is self-correcting. When the science is wrong, we hear about it very quickly from other scientists. And so this whole idea that science is an opinion and that everyone's opinions are valid and that you may have 99% of scientists or 99.5% of scientists who say global warming is a real thing, and you can find 5 or 10 scientists who will say, no, global warming is just crap, that's not true, and their opinions are as valid as everybody else's opinions? No, I'm sorry, they're not. It is the scientific consensus which is important. And that if those 5 or 10 people who think that global warming is not true can present evidence to the fact that it is not, and it can be reproduced and it can be verified, then they can convince the other 99% that they are correct. But until that happens, and until they can actually produce that evidence, and we can verify it and test it and show that, then they're just statistical noise, is really what they are. And so the science is self-correcting in and of itself. And we're going to talk a lot about models as we go forward and the utilization of different models and what is a scientific model. A scientific model is really a theory of how something works. And we will change theories and look at many, many different theories of how something works. And that doesn't mean that the theory is wrong, and it doesn't mean that the theory is basic. The theory works for whatever it is that we're trying to explain. And as long as the theory works, then it's a good and it's a valid theory. Even if there's a theory that is above that, that supplants that, that is better. Sometimes those basic theories can be extraordinarily useful, and we'll teach them. So we'll find that as we go through chemistry, that we will change our idea of theories and how things work. And so some things that I'm going to teach you in this class, as we get into Chem 1A and Chem 1B and Chem 12, we'll revise them, we'll improve them, we'll change them a little bit. We'll tell you that we lied to you slightly. We didn't actually lie to you, we just told you a more simplified theory that was appropriate at the time. And things will change as we move forward. So that's a little bit about the science itself. The science is self-correcting, and we are always open to taking in new information. So what is chemistry then? What is it that we study? We study matter. So chemistry is the study of matter. And then what is matter? So matter is anything that takes up space, occupies volume, that's the way that we say it. Matter, anything that occupies volume and has mass. That's just about everything. We also study, it's not just the study of matter, it's the study of matter and how it interacts with energy. So energy actually gets thrown in here too. And that energy can be light energy, heat energy, thermal energy. And so when you start to look at matter and energy, that is everything that we can see, everything that we can touch, everything that we can feel, smell. It is the physical world around us. So chemistry literally is the study of the physical environment and world around us and the composition of such and what it is made up of and how it reacts and how it interacts with other matter. That, in a nutshell, is the study of chemistry. And one of the first places that we start when we start to look at chemistry and we start our study of matter is something called the kinetic molecular theory. The kinetic molecular theory is the theory of motion. I think the book has kinetic molecular theory later on in the book. It doesn't have it in this first chapter, but I think it's important to bring it up in this first chapter in terms of what it actually states, what it is. The kinetic molecular theory says that all matter is made up of small particles. And for now, we're just going to call them particles. We could call them atoms. So atoms are our smallest division of matter, but we'll get into that in a little bit. And these small particles are always in motion. And that motion is proportional to energy and to how hot they are. So that symbol, proportional to. That means that the faster something is moving, the hotter it is. Or the hotter something is, the faster it's moving. But all particles are always in motion, even when they're at their absolute coldest. So as cold as we can make something, there is still molecular motion when we make something even as cold as we possibly can. And so this motion of these particles is relative to temperature. It's relative to how hot something is. And when we look at the different types of matter, be them solid, liquid, or gas, that solids, liquids, and gases of the same material are made up of the exact same thing, that their particles are no different. The only difference between a solid, liquid, and gas is the speed at which the particle is moving. It literally is how much degrees of freedom or how much motion there are in the particles. So when we look at a solid, one way to look at a solid is to say, all right, if I have a solid, and you can look at any solid around you, the table that you were sitting at, the chair that you were sitting in, that solid is made up of particles, and that those particles are bound sort of in a crystal structure. And that while they're in the solid, they don't move from place to place in the solid. For instance, if I take a look at just one of these particles and I look at that particle right there, that particle will always be in that same place in that solid anytime I look at it. That the particles within a solid cannot migrate or move from one location to another location. However, what they can do is that if I sort of like blow this up and look at what this particle is doing, this particle that I'm eyeing that's in the center here, this particle is jiggling and moving and bouncing around off the other particles that it's next to and colliding with them, such that all the particles are slightly moving within the solid, and they have a sphere with which they move within, but they can't move out of that sphere. So a particle that is on the table to your left can never move to the table on your right. It always is stuck in the same place. But it's always in motion. The motion never stops. They just jiggle very sort of quietly in that location, in that space where they are. And if we think about that solid as it sits inside a container has a fixed dimension. It has a length and a width and a depth, and it occupies a volume that is a finite volume. So the solid has fixed dimensions. If we take and we look at a liquid in this case, we need a different sort of idea or view. In a liquid, the particles are not trapped in a crystal structure. They're free to move around throughout the liquid. And so a particle that is in one location could move and bounce off of things and go any direction that it wants. The particle is free to move around, although the particle has not changed from the particles of the solid. For instance, if we're looking at water, Water is constructed of an oxygen and two hydrogens. Ice, which is solid water, has the same structural formula as liquid water. It's still an oxygen and two hydrogens as the base molecule for that water. The difference between the solid and the liquid, there is no difference in the material itself, only in the degrees of freedom that material has. So when we look at the liquid and think about that liquid sitting in the same sort of Erlenmeyer flask, then what we have is we have particles which are moving throughout this volume and can go any place they want and move throughout it freely. And it has a fixed volume but variable shape. The variable shape really means that if I pour this into some other container, for instance, if I take and I put it into more of a square container, that liquid would assume the square shape. And so the shape is variable while the volume is fixed. And the way that I get from a solid to a liquid is I just add heat. The heat increases the molecular vibrations. And in the solid, if you think about what's happening in the solid, is that the particles are sort of bouncing off of each other within the solid. And that what happens is you put more heat into it, the collisions get more violent. As the collisions get more violent, eventually what happens is the collisions get strong enough that they overwhelm the attractive forces and the particles are able to break free. So what's happening here is that as I add more heat into this, these collisions become more violent and this sphere increases until it actually breaks free of these other particles. And once it breaks free, it's free to move around the entire volume. It overwhelms the attractive forces. And so heat relates to the amount of energy and motion that the particles actually have. And Ellis, I see the question, I'll get there in a second. And so what's happening here is that as we put more heat into it, and I add even some more additional heat, I can go to a gas. And the gas particles, water particles, look exactly like the liquid and the solid. The only difference is now is that a gas particle has much more degrees of freedom of movement, and there are many fewer of them in a given area. And in order to see the gas, what I need to do is I need to put it in a container with a lid on it. And that gas, if we think about that gas as sort of being, let's do it this way, occupying the entire volume. And that now what I've got is individual particles which are moving and bouncing off of things in the gas, whereas in the liquid state, I was only occupying what was here, or in this concept, in the square sort of concept there. And so the gas particles have much more degrees of freedom of movement. Okay, so does complete stillness exist then, or would everything have at least a small amount of energy? That's a great question. What we have is a hypothetical point that we call zero Kelvin. Zero Kelvin is hypothetically where all motion stops, but we have been able to get to within fractions of a Kelvin. I mean, fractions like a 10,000th of a Kelvin or smaller, and we still see molecular motion. So the point at which all motion stops is a theoretical point that has never been obtained, and we have never actually been able to do that. And yet that definition expands to that, and we say that theoretically, at zero Kelvin, all motion stops. Although I don't think that extends to electrons, and so you still have motion within the atom itself, while the motion of the atom would cease. That's what we think of as zero Kelvin. But again, it's a hypothetical spot. For right now, we can assume that no matter what the temperature is, there's always molecular motion associated with it. And that the hotter something is, the more motion there actually is. Okay? And another way to think about this is that when we look at the particles are very densely packed within the solid. So if I'm looking at the solid, particles are very densely packed. When I go to a liquid, they have more space around them. When I go to a gas, they have even more space around them. So when I look at the amount of space that's occupied by the particles itself, for a solid, the particles occupy approximately something like, 85 to 90% of the volume are occupied by the particles. So 85 to 90%. And that means that I've got like 15 to 10% that is empty space. When I go to a liquid, the particles occupy, let's just do it this way. I'm going to copy this and then we'll adjust it. So the particles over here in a liquid occupy somewhere in the range of about 75 to 80%. And that means that I've got something like 25 to 20% of empty space. When I get to a gas is pretty astounding that the particles that are here occupy 0.1% of the space. And that 99.9% is empty in a gas. This is why gases are compressible, why you can take and you can compress a gas and change its volume. Whereas liquids and solids are called condensed matter and are incompressible for the most part. This is also why you can take a wine bottle. It's a great demo. You can take a wine bottle that is full of wine and has a really solid cork in it, and you can use it to drive a nail. You can put a nail into wood by hitting it with the bottle as long as that lid is on there really tight and there is no air bubbles inside the bottle. That bottle will drive a nail into a piece of wood because the bottle is incompressible. The liquid is keeping the bottle from deforming, and the glass is rigid enough to be able to drive the nail. However, take the water out and hit the same nail with the glass, and the glass just shatters. It's because the bottle will bend as soon as it hits the nail. The glass will reach its breaking point, and the glass will break. So gases are compressible. They can change their volumes. They have no fixed volume, and they have no fixed shape. But solids and liquids have fixed volumes and are incompressible in the way that gases are compressible. So that's one of the first things to recognize is these differences between the phases. They are all the exact same particles. They just have a difference in their range of motion and the degrees of freedom that each of those have. Okay. How much temp difference to cause the great space? The temp difference depends on the material itself. It depends on the intermolecular attractive forces. So that is completely dependent upon the material itself. So how much of a temp difference to cause the great space consumption difference? Yeah, every material has what is called a melting point and a boiling point. The melting point and boiling point are the amount of energy required to cause what's called a phase change, to go from one phase, liquid or solid, to gas. And that is dependent upon the size of the molecule and the strength of the intermolecular attractive forces that we want to overwhelm. Would I say it's a relation, a linear relation? No, not exactly. I wouldn't necessarily, I think I'm interpreting the question. Maybe as we input heat, molecular motion does increase linearly? Does the space increase linearly up to a point? So that as you take a solid and you heat a solid expands. You can think of this as something as simple as an engine block or a metal ring that you put into a flame. What you can do is you can take a ball, a sphere, and a ring that is designed to be able to allow that ball to go through. And if we try to put the ball through the hoop, the ball won't go through the hoop because the ball and the hoop are just about the same amount of size. If I take the hoop and I heat it, and put it over a flame, what happens is the ring gets hot. And as the ring gets hot, the particles that are inside the ring expand. And as they expand, the entire dimensions of the ring expands. And the loop gets just a little bit bigger. Oh, it shrunk back down on me. Come on. Sometimes when you try to do little movements, there it goes. And so now while this is hot, as we've heated it up, the ball will now easily pass through. And and the reason that that happens is that when we look in a solid, and we look at a particle that is sitting here in the middle of the solid, we've talked about this ring or sphere of influence that the particle has that is three-dimensional in essence, that this particle bounces around and it's jiggling with all of its other partners. And so all these other spheres that are in there, it's colliding with them. But as I impart more energy to it and I add heat to it, we can think about that little particle as just having small amounts of motion and sort of a sphere of influence that it has as it bounces into its other particles. As I put more energy into it, that particle increases in its molecular motion. And as it increases in its molecular motion, I don't want to say that the particle gets bigger. The particle stays the exact same size. But what winds up happening is now its motion is greater. And as its motion is greater, its sphere that it can move within is greater. And because the sphere is greater, the average distance between the particles has increased. So this distance increases. And as that distance increases, what that causes is a greater average distance between each one of the atoms. And as the distance increases, the overall object expands. And so as I heat things like this, what winds up happening in heating them is that the object actually increases in size. And so my object actually gets bigger because the particle now, being hot, just has more average room around it and it has created a bigger sphere. So this is what we call thermal expansion. And that thermal expansion happens for almost all materials. That when we heat all materials, they thermally expand because their particles are moving faster, creating more distance with heavier collisions, harder collisions. And that's the thermal expansion that happens with solids. It also happens with liquids, that if you take a liquid and you heat a liquid, the liquid will also thermally expand so that you can measure the volume of a liquid when it's cold and the volume of a liquid when it's hot and see an appreciable change in the liquid. Okay, and it also happens with gases, that gases will thermally expand, which is why hot air balloons work, is because the gases expand within the hot air balloon when the gas is hot, and that changes its density and changes its buoyancy. And so thermal expansion is an important concept within the kinetic molecular theory in thinking about how materials transform from solid to liquid to gas, right? Those are great, great things. Okay, think I hit everything there I wanted to hit. All right, so we got some other terms that we got to define. We got mass. What is mass? Mass is a measure of the amount of matter in an object. How does that relate to weight? Mass and weight are not the same thing. So when we think about mass and weight, mass does not equal weight. Mass is independent of gravity. So when we think about the measure of the amount of matter in an object, this is really independent of gravity. So mass does not equal weight. Weight is really a measure of force. And that force is the force that is generated by the mass through gravity. So it is a measure of force acting on a mass through gravity. So that if we take a little person and on Earth, this person weighs 180 pounds. And we think about those pounds as really the weight. And we take that person and we move him to different locations. And so let's take him and we'll put him on the moon. We could also put him on Mars or on Jupiter. And as we change these different planets, the moon being really tiny, our person here, I need to just copy the person. Our person doesn't change in terms of the amount of mass that's in the person. The person has the exact same amount of mass, but the weight changes because the amount of gravity is different. So he would weigh 29.8 pounds on the moon, on Mars, 67.8 pounds. And on Jupiter, Jupiter being massive, with much higher gravity, 455 pounds. And while the mass would stay essentially unchanged, let's see. So if he's 180 pounds, that's times 453.6 grams per pound divided by 1,000, that puts him at 81.6 kilograms. 81.6 kilograms, 81.6 kilograms, and 81.6 kilograms, this being the mass. Measuring mass in kilograms, we think of grams and kilograms as being a measure of mass, not a measure of weight, whereas pounds actually is a measure of weight instead. We think about it as mass, and sometimes it's used interchangeably as mass. But really, it's a measure of weight. Okay? Is everybody catching up? We doing okay? All right. The next thing I want to hit is classification. Oh, no, let's see. The law of conservation of matter.
Jason?
Yes.
Before you move on, could you just go back really quickly to where you defined matter, just so I can get the definition?
Matter, anything that occupies volume and has mass.
Thank you. Perfect. Got it.
Good. Okay. And remember too, I'm going to make these notes available online too. So these go up immediately with the lecture. So all that stuff is there too. And we'll all be available for you. Okay, the law of conservation of matter. This is the other reason I don't like lecturing with PowerPoint, is because I find that even when I'm just writing on the board, I can go a whole heck of a lot faster than most people. Give me PowerPoint and you don't stand a chance. It's great for some things. It's not great for everybody. The law of conservation of matter says that there is no change in the quantity of matter in a chemical change or a physical change. So when a chemical change or a physical change occurs, there is no change in the quantity of matter. When a chemical change or physical change occurs, there is no change in the amount of matter. This is really important that we have the law of conservation of matter and we have the law of conservation of energy. Matter cannot be created or destroyed. Matter is consistent. It may change from one form to another form, but it cannot change the amount of matter that is there. We cannot create matter, nor can we destroy matter. So when we have a chemical change or a physical change that occurs, and we'll define chemical change or physical change later, but when we have any sort of change in the system, the amount of matter cannot change. The amount of matter is a fixed amount and will always remain the same. And so we always talk about the mass balance. One concept here is mass balance, meaning that however much mass I put into a change, the mass initial must equal the mass final. So when you add up all the mass of the reactants, then all the mass of the products must equal the mass of the reactants. That always has to be true. And so when we get less than all of the mass back in the products, we ask, well, what happened to the mass balance? Where did the mass go? And there is always loss to the environment. There's loss to the glassware. There's loss to little things that the chemists do. But on the whole, we can't really lose material. There's no material lost in the chemical reaction. That when we look at the chemical reaction as a whole, the mass that we started with has to be exactly the same as the mass that we finish with. That there's just no way to be able to lose mass. Mass cannot just disappear.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So if matter cannot be created or destroyed, does that mean that, like, from the very beginning of time, we have the same amount of matter now as compared to like when life started?
Oh, that's a great question. The answer is essentially yes. But that goes, it's a harder thing to answer entirely. Okay, so our theory of the universe and the way that the universe works is that at some point, from all of the all the material that we can observe that is in the universe, we can extrapolate back. We know that the universe is expanding, and we know that depending upon the ways that we measure it, we get different rates at which the universe is expanding. But if we extrapolate back, we can extrapolate back to a point where the universe was very, very tiny consisted basically of what we call a, I've lost the term for it, but a singularity. And for whatever reason, and we don't know the reason, that singularity exploded. And when it exploded, it expanded tremendously fast. And it exploded in an amazing release of energy. So much energy that elements could not form. The particles were so hot, the subatomic particles were so hot that they overwhelmed their attractive forces and could not form actual matter. It was only subatomic particles that existed at the initial point of the Big Bang. Those particles, as they cooled, the attractive forces began and they coalesced into initially the first element, which is hydrogen. That hydrogen then cooled even more, and large glass gas clouds of hydrogen formed that had so much gravity that so much energy started to be created within them that those hydrogen atoms slammed into one another. And when they slammed into one another, they did so with such force that they were able to stick, and the nuclei within them fused to make heavier elements. If we take all of the hydrogen that was created in the Big Bang and we look at all of the matter that we have now, that is consistent. That matter has not changed and has not gone anywhere. That matter is all the same matter that we have now. The matter can change, just as I was saying, that the hydrogen was fused into helium, and the helium was fused into lithium and beryllium and carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and all of those elements that we have of life, and all of the 118 elements that are on the periodic table. And it is the stars that create all of those elements. And so, yes, in essence, all of that matter that has been here since the beginning of the Big Bang is all still here and will all still be here forever, essentially. We do have an idea that certain elements have what's called a radioactive decay. Some elements, when they combine, and we'll get into this very towards the end of the class, some elements decompose. By decomposing, they eject out a particle of energy, or they eject out part of their nucleus, or they eject out a subatomic particle, an electron. And when they do, they change to a lighter element. But when you take the mass of that chemical reaction, about all of that that happens, the mass is still conserved. So no matter what, the law of conservation of matter says that the matter that I start with and the matter that I end with, regardless of the forms of that matter, is all consistent. So that's a great question, Megan. Thank you for that. Vanessa, what about black holes? Where does that matter go? That matter goes into the black hole and is so compressed by the black hole that that it takes up much less space than it would normally. Essentially, what winds up happening is, we think, in a black hole, that the individual atoms themselves cease to exist, and it becomes a soup of subatomic particles that exist within the black hole, and yet the matter is still conserved. So if I take all of the matter that has fallen into the black hole and I measure the mass of the black hole, those two masses are still the same, and there is still the law of conservation of matter. That is, and that's why we call that a law, is that it, no matter how many times we do this experiment, how many times we measure it, we find that it's always consistent, and that matter is never lost. It never just goes no place. All right. And I guess the one other thing that I could add there is, well, then what about these new elements that they create in these atomic accelerators? So if I take two very light atoms and I slam them into each other and I create new elements, like at the Hadron Collider, where they're looking at trying to find new subatomic particles and things, there essentially what they're doing is they're taking electrons and swinging electrons around a loop, getting them almost to the speed of light before they slam them into each other, and new elements wind up being created in that. It still has the same conservation of matter, that any matter that goes into that is present at the end of the collision. It just may be in a different form, in a different element, once it coalesces. And so we still have conservation of matter, even in those experiments, which is really cool. So nothing is ever just created out of thin air. Nothing disappears into thin air. There's no magic about it. It's one of the things that's really cool. Okay, so that's our conservation of matter. The next thing that we need to do is we need to look at classifications of matter. So we classify matter into different types. So as we classify matter, there's two big classifications. We have pure substances, and we have mixtures. And out of the pure substances, a pure substance is said to be pure in that it cannot physically be separated. And the mixtures, these over here, can be physically separated. So what do I mean by physically separated? Physical separation can be like filtration. Or sometimes we could say distilled. Distilled is something that separates materials based on their boiling points. And so you can think about wine distillery, that when you're distilling something, you're heating it up and you're separating out the alcohol from the water. That's a physical sort of process. It's not a chemical process. The physically cannot be separated. Filtration or distillation cannot separate these pure substances. They are inseparable in that way. They can be chemically separated, so we can do a chemical process to separate them. And they break down into two different types. One type is an element, and the other type is a compound. So elements are the smallest component of matter that retain the properties of the bulk material. And these can't be broken down. And when we say they cannot be broken down, what we mean is that they can't be broken down into other elements. They can be broken down into subatomic particles. They have electrons, they have neutrons, they have protons. And even the protons and neutrons can be broken down into gluons. There's all these different subatomic particles that, yeah, we ended 1225. Oh, we do end at 1225. I should cut it and give people a break. Thank you for that. We can come back and finish the rest of this anyway. Elements can't be broken down into anything smaller. Compounds are components of elements, made of elements, and they can be broken down into elements themselves, but they can't be physically separated. We'll look at mixtures, and we'll go on to the rest of that, and we'll pick it up from there tomorrow. But I think we've got a good start at things, and you're right, I got to watch my time a little bit closer. It's 12:30, and we need that break because we need that half hour before we start the afternoon lab. All right, how's everybody doing? Feel like we got a good start? Got some thumbs up. Everybody's doing okay. Lecture format's working for everybody. And cool. Okay. So thank you guys for being here. Thank you for attending. And we'll catch up with you tomorrow. And I'll see you guys in the afternoon lab. And anybody who wants to jump into office hours, you're welcome to jump in at office hours too. This is the end of Chem 3. Yes, correct. And then the 3L is the class that starts after this for the afternoon lab. All right? Okay, you guys, thank you much. If anybody has any questions, I'll stay on the line for a few minutes to catch anybody who might have some last minute questions. And otherwise, you're free to go. I'll see you guys for the afternoon lab, and then I'll see you back for lecture tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Flynn, you still with me? Are the morning and lab afternoon the same? They're the exact same content. You're ascribed into either the morning lab or the afternoon lab. It doesn't matter which one you attend, to my mind. However, when you go and you do your grades, they'll be done in the Canvas shell, and the Canvas shell will put you in the right proper place. So it doesn't really matter which of the labs you attend. You can do either one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And did I just overhear you say that in theory you'd attend either the morning or the afternoon lab?
Yeah, I you know, the reason that we split them up into the two different labs is traditional because of the physical ability to accommodate people in lab.
Right.
there's and it's also a workload issue for instructors. But in terms of if you're enrolled in lab, I really don't have a preference whether you stay within the morning lab or go to the afternoon lab. You can switch back and forth. It's going to be the same content. It's going to be the same material. And you're going to be turning in your assignments within Canvas. So Canvas is going to put you into the class that you're actually enrolled in, and you will be submitting your work in the class that you're actually enrolled in. Which class lecture you attend doesn't really matter.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. Isaac, Chem 3 doesn't take lab. If you're just in the Chem 3 and that's all you need is the Chem 3 and you don't need the lab, you're a UCSC student or you're a CSUMB student or you've completed lab previously but you need to take the lecture, you're absolutely right. You do not need to take a lab. The lab is just there for those people who are Cabrillo students who have not taken lab before and need it to be able to get into Chem 1A or Chem 1B. So I need a little more information to advise you correctly. And Uriel, is there reading for today? Just that, you know, if you stay up with chapter one and you read through chapter one, you'll be in good shape for tomorrow. You got it.
Hey, Jason, I have a question. I'm not enrolled in the class yet because there's no room in the labs.
Right.
How should I go about doing that?
Go in and add yourself onto the wait list, and I'm just going to add everybody from the wait list and give them permission, and then I will send out an email to those people once I have given them permission to add. Then you'll go into your WebAdvisor account and actually add the class.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So, Isaac, you're only taking Chem 3. Are you a UCSC student or CSUMB student or a Cabrillo student? And do you plan on taking, do you plan on taking Chem 1A in the fall? Is that what your goal is? You don't plan on taking the next chemistry. So is this just fulfilling a science requirement for you then for the Chem 3? Okay, then if you think that you might go on and take Chem 1A or Chem 1B at some point, I would recommend taking the lab. If not, then you're fine just taking the lecture. You're welcome. Move up the notes to like here. You're welcome. Okay, does anybody else have any other questions? You guys set? Juan, did you get what you needed? Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and end this session. I'm gonna go take a little break so that I can come back from lab at 1 o'clock, all right? Thanks for a great first class, you guys. Take care.